Jamunatiravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jayam Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parivraja Kachari Ashutara Shatashi Shimara Sivayan Grace Sivakta Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Raja Granth Shima Bhagavatam Ki Jai Gaurandi, all glories to the Summon of Bodies, all glories to Shri Shri Guru and Gauranga. Om Aknana Tamirandasya Naranjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadamayam Vedati Swabhadantikam Vancha Kalputurubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyarevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 25. Which text is it? Today's text 4. Text 4, translation by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. It says here, the pink transparent toenails on the Lord's lotus feet are exactly like valuable gems polished to a mirror finish. It sounds like British English. Polished to a mirror finish. When the unalloyed devotees and the leaders of the snakes offer their obeisances to Lord Sankarsana with great devotion, they become very joyful upon seeing their own beautiful faces reflected in his toenails. Their cheeks are decorated with glittering earrings, and the beauty of their faces is extremely pleasing to see. Next verse, text number 5. Lord Ananta's arms are attractively long. Beautifully decorated with bangles and completely spiritual, they are white and so they appear like silver columns. When the beautiful princesses of the serpent kings, hoping for the Lord's auspicious blessing, smear his arms with aguru pulp, sandalwood pulp, and kumkuma, the touch of his limbs awakens lusty desires within them. Understanding their minds, the Lord looks at the princesses with a merciful smile, and they become bashful, realizing that he knows their desires. Then they smile beautifully and look upon the Lord's lotus face, which is beautified by reddish eyes rolling slightly from intoxication, and delighted by love for his devotees. So this is a purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. When males and females touch each other's bodies, their lusty desires naturally awaken. It appears from this verse that there are similar sensations in spiritual bodies. Both Lord Ananta and the women giving him pleasure have spiritual bodies. Thus, all sensations originally exist in the spiritual body. This is confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmadyasya Yataha. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur has commented in this connection that the word adi means adirasa, the original lusty feeling, which is born from the Supreme. However, spiritual lust and material lust are completely different as gold and iron. Only one who is very highly elevated in spiritual realization can understand the lusty feelings exchanged between Radha and Krishna, or between Krishna and the damsels of Braja. Therefore, unless one is very experienced and advanced in spiritual realization, he is forbidden to discuss the lusty feelings of Krishna and the gopis. However, if one is a sincere and pure devotee, the material lust in his heart is completely vanquished as he discusses the lusty feelings between the gopis and Krishna, and he makes quick progress in spiritual life. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So, from these descriptions, it appears that Ananta has a human form as well as a snake-like form. Understand? I think the previous descriptions we're hearing how Ananta Dev has so many hoods, and the universes are standing on his hoods. Right? That's the descriptions you're all hearing the other day, yesterday. In today's descriptions, though, it's talking about his toenails and his arms and how there are various denizens of the lower regions who are massaging his limbs with various ointments and so on. So it appears here that Ananta has two types of forms. One is like a snake form and one is a human-like form. That's a simple point, right? And so here, his body is completely spiritual. Although he was described as tamasi. And remember, he was described as tamasi yesterday. Why was he described as tamasi? He's the origin of Roshi, was anger. That's what y'all recall, remember? So he's called as tamasi, yes, because he's a supervisor of the mode of ignorance, or Lord Shiva. But his form is not ignorant, his form is transcendental. And that's actually coming up in a few next verses. So his form is transcendental, so also the denizens who are relating with him are also equally transcendental. So Prabhupada is pointing out here in this purport that that the relation that they're sharing is one that is conjugal in nature. Prabhupada compares it to young boys and young girls. When they touch each other, they immediately experience, how does Prabhupada put it? Their lusty desires naturally awaken. Sometimes people ask us, why do you keep the men and women separate? So now we have a Shastric reference point. Next time someone asks us this, we'll just read the sentence. When males and females touch each other's bodies, their lusty desires naturally awaken. Therefore, there's a reason that we keep them separate. And the same reason why we keep the boys and girls bathroom separate. There's intelligence behind that. Because this is a natural reaction to touch. If one touches the object of sex desire, their lusty desires naturally awaken. So so Prabhupada's pointing out here that Anantadev's body is spiritual, and so also the denizens who are relating to him, they're also spiritual. And there a similar sensation is being experienced on the spiritual platform. So when they touch Lord Ananta's arms, these lusty desires become awakened. So just in case anyone's scared about spiritual life lacking some experience, because when we see self-realized souls in the spiritual world, they're very, in the material world, their characteristic is sober. Krishna describes, for one who understands that there's a difference between consciousness and matter, then their disposition in the material world is one of sobriety. So oftentimes we feel that one may feel or misconstrue spiritual life to be one devoid of the fun experiences of the material world. As such, sex life and so on is considered to be fun and joyful. It's the epitome, of course, of joyful experiences in the material world. So sometimes when you see the sobriety of a spiritually elevated person, then one feels a little bit disconcerted about, well, is this going to be dull and boring? Where's the fun life? In fact, I think Himanshu was sharing us with our Bhakta Curtis before he finally left. He left for a couple of days and he took some intoxication and he got the realization that it was God. So this is the power of intoxication. He got the realization he was God, and he also realized that he was inhibiting himself. What's the word? Yeah, like. Yeah, restraining himself, repression, you know, there's repression. And I really want to go out and have fun and do drugs like this. So when persons see spiritually elevated personalities in their interaction in the material world, they feel that there will be some lacking in spiritualization. But in the bhakti conception of spiritual perfection, perfection is an emotional state. It's filled with all the fun emotions also that is experienced in the material world as well. But the nice things about those emotions is that they culminate in greater and greater bliss, anandam buddhi vardhanam, as whereas the same emotions reflecting the material world culminate in despondency or grief, such as the message of the chapter on Bhagavad Gita. So by hearing these descriptions, one need not feel concerned about if spiritual life is fun or not, or are lacking in some way. Spiritual life is not lacking. It's filled with all the powerful emotions that are also experienced in the material world in a perverted degree, in a perverted way. So Prabhupada points it out here also in the purport. It appears from this verse that there are similar sensations in spiritual bodies because everything originates in the Supreme. Jamadhyaya yasya yataha. So everything is there in the spiritual world. So here we're hearing how there's some spiritual denizens are relating to Lord Ananta in a conjugal way. So such an experience is also available on the spiritual platform, conjugal love. But then Prabhupada points our attention to that love and lust are like gold and iron. Although they may have a similar appearance, the two are not actually the same. So who is qualified to hear about such interactions? Hearing about conjugal interactions is very seductive. Just like romance literatures are very popular. I remember right when I was starting to investigate spiritual life more, I saw a book in our mother's house called Only Love Is Real. And it had like a picture of a man and woman kind of facing each other in a, amorous sort of position and so on. It was a silhouette, so you couldn't see anything. But you know, from the silhouette, the imagination can be catalyzed and so on. So I thought it was a romance literature. You know, when I saw it, I was 18 years old at the time. So I thought, oh, I've never read a romance literature before. And because I was also looking for love and so on, so it was very seductive to read a romance literature. So I read it. It was about reincarnation. it's a book by a famous psychiatrist named Brian Weiss, who kind of stumbled upon past life regression. And it was his second book, which talked about two souls who were kind of passing in their lives and meeting each other in several different lifetimes. Anyway, it's an interesting book. And so reading that book augmented my quest for spirituality after reading it and so on. So anyway, hearing about the conjugal affairs of even a mundane woman and man is very seductive and attractive, it's tempting. So once one comes to discover that such emotions are also existing on the spiritual platform, it is natural that they become the most attractive thing to want to investigate or discover. Just as it is in the material sense, you want to find out about what is those loving reaction interactions like. So it comes of no surprise that hearing about Krishna's exchange with the gopis and so on is the most attractive element of our philosophy. Everyone wants to kind of understand what are those loving affairs. So Prabhupada points out here in the purport that those affairs can be easily misunderstood on account of our tendency to impose the mundane idea onto the spiritual. For one who is not spiritually elevated, then it is very natural for us to impose a grosser idea onto a subtler idea. I sent this something from Acharya Dev, actually, put on my blog. This analogy is given just like one sees cloud, dusty air or cloudy space. Now, space can never be cloudy because space is essentially different from clouds. Space can't actually interact with anything. It doesn't mix with anything. But the idea here is that when we see clouds, we say that the space is cloudy. In other words, we're imposing something that's more gross onto something that's more subtle. Right? Does that make sense? Or we see dusty air. Air and dust can't actually mix together at all. That's not actually possible. This analogy is given in the first canto, third chapter, I think verse like 30 or 31. So we say the air is dusty, but that's not actually possible because air is very subtle and it can't actually mix with dust at all. But yet we say that the air is dusty in our normal way of speaking. So we are imposing a grosser idea onto a subtler reality and then coming up with a misconception or assumption. Does it make sense? So similarly, the tendency when one is conditioned is to impose a grosser idea onto a more subtle idea. So then when one hears about the conjugal affairs of the gopis, which are natural and attractive, the tendency is to impose a grosser idea onto a more subtle idea. And so the mundane relationships appear to be the same as the spiritual relationships. One misconstrues that and then one falls down. So Prabhupada is giving a little warning here. As such, because of that particular tendency. At what point does one really become qualified to hear about those things? Sometimes the criticism is offered that we always hear that we should hear about Krishna, but we do a lot less hearing about Krishna and we discuss a lot of the philosophy. This is a charge that is often made by many individuals. And the question is, why do we do that? Why do we talk more about the philosophy than the actual hearing about Krishna? Of course, as a tangential point, we should do both. We should do some hearing about Krishna. But the methodology we do when we hear about Krishna should be the methodology that Shukadeva Goswami took when dealing with persons who weren't on the highest levels of devotion to Krishna. And the assembly in which Shukadeva Goswami was addressing, there were all sorts of personalities there, karmis, gyanis, yogis, and bhaktas. Probably amongst the boxes there were some neophytes, some intermediate devotees, some advanced devotees, like that. So then, when he spoke of Krishna's pastimes, he laced the discussion of those pastimes with so much philosophy. So there's Lila Katha, and there's what Shukadeva Goswami did. What Shukadeva Goswami did is not exactly Lila Katha. Lila Katha is exclusively the Leela, no philosophy is discussed, just hearing about Krishna, his exchanges with the Braja gopis and gopas and so on. It's not laced with philosophical dissertation. The reason for that is because it's not required for those souls who are on such an elevated platform. They're hearing those pastimes from the context of the realization of the technical language is their Stayi Bhava. You know this language, Stayi Bhava. Stayi Bhava refers to, Stayi means like the fixed Bhava, so the fixed relationship in one of the four rasas, five, but generally in Gaudiya Vaishnavism we accept four rasas, Dasa rasa, Sakya rasa, Vatsalya rasa, and Madhurya rasa. So then the culmination of sadhana bhakti is, what is that? What is the culmination of sadhana bhakti? Stayi bhava, actually. Stayi bhava bhakti. Bhava bhakti is not just like a generalization Although we just normally, it's Bhav Bhakti, but what does Bhav Bhakti mean? The platform of Bhav Bhakti is not different from the attainment of what is also called the Swarup Siddhi, where one realizes the perfection of his own Sthayi Bhava or eternal fixed relationship with Krishna. So when Leela Katha is going on, they're hearing that Katha from the context of their Sthayi Bhava. Or for advanced sadhakas who are completely detached from matter, they are also hearing those pastimes with the view of cultivating those particular sentiments. But what Shukadeva Goswami does in the Bhagavatam is when he discusses the leelas, he laces it with a lot of philosophy. Why? Because there's so many personalities who are not spiritually elevated. So if they hear exclusively Leela Katha, then this conditioned natural tendency of Arupitam is the Sanskrit word of imposition takes place, where they will impose their mundane idea onto the spiritual. So then, therefore, after discussing the pastimes of the Braja Gopis with Krishna, Parashar Maharaj just poses a question: how could Krishna dance with other people's wives? Now, Parashar Maharaj is now on such a platform where he needs to ask that question. He understands what is Krishna's position. But because he knew there were so many people in the audience that weren't on that level, and this doubt would have come up in their mind naturally on account of not being so elevated, so he asks this question, in which Shukadeva Goswami speaks somewhat, how you say, like in a chiding, he kind of chides the audience through Parashar Maharaj. You know this example of, what is it, how does Prabhupada call it? It's a Bengali saying, you chastise the daughter-in-law through the daughter. Because you don't have a proper relationship with the daughter-in-law, so she's doing something that's like really irritating you, you know? And so when the daughter comes home, you just start blasting the daughter, and she's like, what's going on, you know? But exactly, but you do it in front of the daughter-in-law so that she can understand that this is her fault. And that way you indirectly address her because of the lack of natural relationship. So also, Parashar Maharaj speaks sort of somewhat chidingly to Parashar Maharaj in order to address the audience who has this tendency to impose mundane reality or a gross reality onto a more subtle reality, like the pastimes of Krishna and the Braja Gopis. So then, this charge is sometimes made by devotees, even in our movement, that why are you spending so much time discussing the philosophy and less time hearing about Krishna when you say that we should just hear and chant about Krishna? You know, I don't think that's a very fair charge, because hearing any part of the Bhagavatam is certainly hearing about Krishna. There would be no reason for Parashar Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami to engage in such a long discussion if it wasn't also Krishna Katha. And then the other point is that why not directly hearing about Krishna's pastimes exclusively or more exclusively is because of this point of lack of realization. It is not that we can just turn our minds off and say, I won't think in that particular way. If you don't have that realization, you must think in that particular way. Avasham Pakritaya Vashat, Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita how the living entities are helplessly being moved by the impressions of their previous karmas. In other words, we're all born with a type of prejudices that are fixed in our subtle body at the time of birth. So someone thinks like in a particular sort of way, and they are against a certain sort of, and it's all fixed in their subtle body at the time of their birth. So it's not that you can, just by hearing a class, you'll just stop thinking that way automatically. You are forced to think in that way. Avasham means helplessly, one is thinking in that way, on account of strong conditioning. So therefore, when one hears about Krishna's lusty affairs, then it's not that I'll just remember that it's all transcendental, I won't be affected. You must think in a lusty way, naturally. I remember one devotee friend of mine, he was reading the Krishna book, and when he got to the pastimes with the gopis, I don't even think, and the way Prabhupada writes in the Krishna book is very, you know, how you say, like chaste, simple. But even when he was reading that, he said, Prabhu, my mind is getting really disturbed. And he said, what should I do? And he had another devotee guy. So I said, what did the devotee tell you? What did he suggest? He said, just somehow or other get through it, you know, chapter by chapter. And then I said, so why don't you try it out? So then the next day he called me and said, Prabhu, my mind is like in the nighttime, and, you know, dreams are coming up and so on. So I said, maybe it's best to stop for, and Chaupati, I was just there in Chaupati, and they were on chapter 37, which is right after the pastimes of Krishna with the gopis. So they Gauranga Prabhu told me, they said they did one chapter a day. When it came, so the Pancha Rasadhyaya has five chapters are there. And one chapter they did per day. They didn't even go through that. And, you know, part of that is like one feels somewhat cheated, you know, because there is valuable transcendental knowledge there that is powerful enough to remove the lust in the heart. That's what the end of the pastimes with the gopi says. But they went through it in 5 days because people just aren't there yet. And this aropitam, this tendency of imposition takes place by which it becomes necessary to gloss over that discussion rather than go into detail. But we should know that, as it's mentioned in my Prabhupada in the Isha-Upanishad, that all forms of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete whole. So incomplete knowledge of the complete whole causes an experience of feeling of incompleteness. So from this statement, we should know that these types of discussions are also required in order to feel complete or to experience completeness in relationship to Krishna. In other words, the discussion of Rasa Tattva, like the Nectar Devotion Book or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, normally we study only up to chapter 19. And we're only encouraged usually to study only up to chapter 19 because that's within the realm of the practical. Whereas everything that happens after chapter 19 in the Nectar Devotion deals with Rasa Tattva, and that tends to be more lofty. But we should know that that knowledge was placed there for practitioners, actually, in order to help them experience completeness in relationship to the Absolute. As Prabhupada says, again, all forms of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge. So Rasa Tattva is also part of the knowledge that's required for us to be able to enter more deeply into Krishna consciousness. So then at what point does a person become qualified for such hearing, where it's actually effective and not detrimental, potentially detrimental? So Prabhupada says here, unless one is a very experienced and advanced in spiritualization, he is forbidden to discuss the lusty feelings of Krishna and the gopis. However, if one is a sincere and pure devotee, the material lust in the heart is completely vanquished as he discusses the lusty feelings between the gopis and Krishna, and he makes quick progress in spiritual life. So this is a very important sentence that Prabhupada brings out. At what point does someone become qualified to really get into those types of discussions by which it vanquishes all the unwanted things in the heart, the less mundane lust in the heart, and one can make quick spiritual progress? So then this discussion is there mentioned by Rupa Goswami. The first thing that is required for this type of hearing is called loba. Loba means greed. Greed for the absolute truth. And it's not that anyone can just say, I have loba. One fine day you wake up and you have loba. Loba, the context of following Vaidhi Sarana Bhakti and Gaudiya Vaishnavism as presented by the Goswamis is for the purpose of generating genuine loba. Loba is the minimum qualification for practicing what's called Raghunuga Sarana. And Raghunuga Sadhana, you have these five stages known as Shravanam Dasha, Varana Dasha, Smaranam Dasha. You know these things? Apani Dasha and Sampati Dasha. You know this language? Prabhupada discusses this in Nectar of Instruction. Nectar of Instruction means the text number 8. The essence of all, the Upadesha Sadham, the essence of all instructions is discussed. And which Prabhupada brings up this discussion of Shravanam Dasha. These five dasha means stage. So these five dashas, beginning with Shravanam Dasha does not refer to Shravanam of the nine forms of devotional service. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, and so on. The Shravanam Dasha that's mentioned there is actually exclusively in the context of Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. And Shravanam Dasha refers to hearing exclusively the pastimes of Krishna, which relates to the particular bhava that you're trying to cultivate in relationship to Krishna. So spending most of the time hearing and chanting about those particular pastimes is called Shravanam Dasha. It's in the context of wanting to understand and realize a particular type of bhava of one of the Braja Gopis or Gopas and Braja in the spiritual world. So when do you become qualified for that type of practice? I mean, it begins there. I'm not going to go through a detailed discussion of all the stages, but it begins with Shravana Jap. When do you become qualified for that type of practice where one is hearing exclusively or for the most part only activities which nourish one's particular bhava? This is called as, these all have technical names. Where, when does one come, I'm trying to think of the name right now. Nija, huh? No, I already, no. It has a, Nija, my, I'm forgetting a word here. Anyway, it'll come back to me later. In the context of cultivating Raghunuga Sadhana, this becomes an essential element of hearing things that exclusively nourish your own bhava in relationship, the bhava that you're trying to attain in relationship to the Absolute. But the main criteria for doing that is not that I just want to do that. The main criteria is loba. So, and loba means intense greed. This is the only thing that's mentioned by Rupa Goswami as qualification for Raghunuga Sadhana. But then, how does one know if one's loba is genuine or not? Because Srila Bhaktisiddhanta took a lot of issue with how Raghunuga Sadhana was being applied in his time. And therefore, he took a revolutionary approach to Sadhana Bhakti by apparently emphasizing only Vaidhi Bhakti. And for this reason, many people are against Srila Bhaktisiddhanta outside of the Gaudiya Math, which includes ISKCON. Many people are actually against Srila Bhaktisiddhanta because of this. They speak very disparagingly of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta because of his revolutionized approach to Sadhana Bhakti. And there's a reason for this, because he took issue with the way it was being applied. People who were still showing attraction to the mundane features of material existence and simultaneously trying these various esoteric practices of Krishna consciousness, then it led to degradation of the pure line of thought in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. A degradation which, of course, is still continuing today. So how does one know when one's loba is genuine? Genuine greed for the Absolute. Jiva Goswami comments in the Bhaktisandarbha that loba is genuine when there is complete detachment from matter. Then from that platform, it can be said that one has a genuine loba. The loba means that the greed for the Absolute becomes so intense that there can be no desire for other things. The desire for the Absolute is so intense that other desires can't penetrate it. So loba is a very deep thing. Mukunda Goswami, he's one acharya who also gave a commentary on the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He said that it is more rare to achieve loba in sadhana bhakti than it is to achieve bhava by vaidhi bhakti. Such as he speaks in a somewhat discouraging way about the actual attainment of genuine loba. Anyway, so the point is that when one becomes a sincere and pure devotee. So sincere and pure devotee means a uttama adhikari. Uttama adhikari is different from a uttama bhagavat. Uttama adhikari, adhikari means eligibility. So one who has the greatest eligibility for further advancement in sadhana. So one has to become an uttama adhikari. That doesn't mean he's an uttama bhagavat, but an uttama adhikari. This language is given by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. At which stage does one become an uttama adhikari or pure devotee? A pure devotee means a pure sadhaka, eligible for these higher levels and esoteric aspects of the practice. When does he become such a adhikar, uttama adhikar? Then that is identified at the stage of ruchi, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and also Jiva Goswami. He calls it Jataruchi, Sadhana Bhakti, Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. So at the stage of Ruchi is expressed by Lord Chaitanya as Nandanam Najanam Nasundari Kavitam Vajagadisha Kamaye, which happens to be a verse which demonstrates detachment from matter. Nandanam, I don't want any dhanam, wealth, I don't want any women, I don't want any followers, I don't even want liberation. All I desire is your pure devotion, birth of the bird. So this verse of Shishashakam is an expression of the Ruchi platform of sadhana. So the Ruchi platform of sadhana exhibits such detachment from matter. At that stage, Jiva Goswami identifies as a stage of genuine loba for the Absolute, at which time more esoteric practices of Krishna consciousness become more relevant for an individual. Otherwise, the hearing that we do is because we have lesser realization. Our hearts are filled with the narcissus. We're not even equipoised in the face of duality. And therefore, the need for hearing so much philosophy and so on comes up, especially when you live in the Western countries or outside the context of a protected environment like Braja, and you're just hanging out with sadhus who are totally relishing prema bhakti rasa or something like that. If you don't have that type of association, then the requirement for hearing the philosophy becomes important as well, or at least taking a chaste approach to the topic, to the leelas, as Shukadeva Goswami takes, becomes necessary, because we're not able to distinguish the difference between lust and love. For example, I'm just going to include with this example, in Krishna's leela, where the cowherd boys ask Krishna. They tell Krishna, "Krishna, we are hungry, and there's this big demon in the Talavan forest who are keeping us from getting the tall fruits. So we are feeling very hungry, so can you go and kill that demon so that we can eat the fruits?" Now this sounds like a straight up fruit of desire, you know, fruit of activity, you know. I'm hungry and there's a demon, so can you go kill him so I can get the fruits? But so when we read that pastime without the context of the emotional content of the gopas, then we say isn't that fruitive? It looks very fruitive and materialistic. You know, I want something, go kill that person because he's an impediment to what I want, so I can get that something. Now, the acharyas, Vishnu Acharya Thakur, points out that the gopas were actually wanting to feed Krishna. But they knew that if they asked Krishna directly, that he would say, "No, no, it is okay. I don't want anything." But they knew that Krishna was attached to them. So they said, if we say that we're hungry, then Krishna will get the fruit for us, and that way we can give it to Krishna. But if we ask him directly, then he will say, "No, no, it is okay. I don't want anything like that." And that way, out of their love for Krishna and their understanding of Krishna's attachment to them, then they express their love in this particular way, which looks externally just like a fruit of desire, but it was actually based on profound love and desire for service to Krishna. That's a very simple example, because I think it makes the point clear that when you're reading it without the emotional content of the eternal resonance, then it looks very much similar to the mundane emotions. And therefore, the need to really understand the philosophy in order to elevate our hearts to a platform where we can enter into the emotional content of the resonance of Braja from a platform of self-realization. Like that, so these are some points that I just gathered. Is someone wants to add something? Okay, so here and then, yeah.
Hare Krishna, bro. Thanks for the class. You say that in the Shikshastaka, that verse that you mentioned, comes from the... It comes from the platform of Vaidisana Bhakti?
The Ruchi platform.
The Ruchi platform. And I was wondering, what about the rest of the verses of the Shikshastaka?
Yeah, okay. So the first verse is an expression of all the stages of Bhakti from Shraddha to Prema. So first Lord Chaitanya says, Param Vijayate, Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. So this Param Vijayate is identified as the stage of Shraddha, because Lord Chaitanya is himself saying it in order to invoke faith in this process. Param Vijayate, so if the Lord is saying it, and we have some faith in the Lord, then we'll have faith in what the Lord is indicating as the best process for... So then, Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. So Sankirtanam refers to the stage of Sadhu Sangha, for Sankirtan is done in the association of sadhus. So this line, Param Vijayate, Sri Krishna Sankirtana, indicates the first two stages of Sadhana Bhakti. And then Chaito Dharpana Marjanam indicates the next two stages of accepting a spiritual master and following the process under his guidance by which anarthas are dissipated. So Chaito Dharpana Marjanam refers to the removal of anarthas. Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam refers to the stage of Nishta. So just as when a forest fire, Baba Mahadavagni, right? So a forest fire is dissipated, sometimes the smoke still remains. So similar at the stage of Nishta, there is still some remnants of attraction to the material nature. But one is liberated from the vast majority of anarthas. What is that? Nashta Prayeshu, Abhidreshu. So when almost all the anarthas are completely extinguished, Srila Prabhupada says that means 75%. Like, I don't know how you would exactly quantify that. Okay, Prabhu, I think I got about 74%. I got about 1 more percent. Anyway, so Prabhupada says 75% of the narcissists are extinguished. That's Baba Mahadevakti Nirvapana indicates the stage of Nishta. Then what happens after that? Shreya Kairiva Chandrika Vitaranam. So this verse indicates the stage of Ruchi, the blossoming of the white lotus. I'm not going to go into great detail there. Vidyavadu Jivanam indicates the stage of Asakti. Anandam Buddhi Pardhanam Pratipadam indicates the stage of Bhava. Pratipadam, then Purnam Rita Swadhanam indicates the stage of Prema. And then Sarvatma Snavana is also Prema. So there's Prema in Vipralamba and Prema in Samboga. So in this way, the first verse indicates all the stages of bhakti. Then the second verse is a further expansion of the Chaito Dharpana Marjanam idea. So the first verse indicates the stage of Bhajana Kriya and Anartha Nivritti. Dur Daivam Indri Shami Hajani Na Nuragahad. Due to Anartha's Dur Daiva misfortune, I'm not able to chant with great taste. So this indicates the stage of Bhajan Kriya and Anartha Nivritti. Then this categorization is according to the Bhajan and Rahasya Bhaktivinoda Thakur, by the way. Then the next verse is Trinada Pisani Chena, etc. This stage is the stage of Nishta. So when one comes to the platform of Nishta, he becomes fixed in these types of qualities. Because Nishta is a platform of Brahma-Bhuta realization. So you're detached from matter and so on. So then these are the qualities that come out from such realization. So Nishta is the third stage, is indicated by the third verse of Shishashtakam. Then the fourth verse is Ruchi. The fifth verse is a discussion of Asakti. Ayinanda Tanujang Kinkaram. So in this verse, we should do a seminar on Shishashtakam, huh? I'm working on one now, actually, because I think it's an important one. In this verse, Ayinanda Tanujang Kinkaram, it's the first place where Lord Chaitanya actually indicates his own relationship with Krishna by saying, Ayinanda Tanuja Kinkaram, I am the Kinkara of Nanda Tanuja, the son of Nanda Maharaj. So it is understood also in the Madhura Kandambini that at the stage of Asakti, one actually starts to get profound realization of his own Siddha Sarup in relationship to Krishna. It means it's revealed at this stage. There are three ways where one's Sarup can be revealed to him according to the Raghavartma Chandrika of Vishwanatha Bhakti Thakur. One way is that the spiritual master reveals it to you by dint of his own spiritual realization, or some powerful Rasik Guru reveals it to you, which is the practice that was going on in our tradition for a long, long time. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta took issue with this practice because people weren't realized. Neither the gurus were realized, neither the followers were realized. And therefore, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta vehemently opposed this application. There is a third way this realization can come, and that's by bhakti herself. Bhakti infused within the heart can give all sorts of realization. And this is told by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Rabbi Bhartma Chandrika, and also by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in his commentary on the Krishna Karnamrita. He mentions this inner revelation. So that's the revelation that we also apply in the Saraswati line, that bhakti revealed it. And that way there is no cheating program that goes on. When bhakti is pleased with you, then bhakti will reveal these things. So then at the stage of Asakti, it appears, which is also within the realm of sadhana, but is very close to perfection. At that stage, one starts to get information from within his heart about his eternal relationship with Krishna. Ayi nanda tanujang kinkaram. This is indicated. So this verse indicates the Asakti stage. It is at this stage that Raghunuga sadhana bhakti and all the esoteric aspects can really be applied in a deep sort of way, because you have the context of realization of your swarup and what you're aspiring for. At that stage, then sadhana, Raghunuga sadhana becomes actually applicable. Otherwise, before that stage, at the stage of Ruchi, there's more focus on the practices. At the stage of Asakti, there's more focus on the relationship with Krishna. So anyway, that verse indicates Asakti. Then the next verse, how does the next verse start? Nayanam Galada Shudharaya. So then tears point from the eyes, like torrents of rain, etc. That's the stage of Bhav Bhakti. And then the next two verses indicate the stage of Prema. Verse number 7 is Vipralamba. I'm experiencing a moment to be like 12 years or more. It's an experience of Vipralamba. which is required for Sambhoga to have any meaning. There would be no use of Sambhoga unless it can be understood after the realization of separation from Krishna. So separation is an important element in Krishna consciousness. This is probably the most important element in Krishna consciousness. That separation makes the meaning all the more meaningful, the meeting all the more meaningful, and the meeting makes the separation all the more meaningful. And the two work kind of, and they have an interdependence. And so in Krishna's pastimes, you'll see that this is always taking place, separation and meeting, separation. Krishna goes to the forest with the gopis, or with the gopas, and then the gopis and the elderly gopis, and they all feel separation from Krishna. And that causes them to sing in Sankirtan. And then Krishna comes back, and then there's Sambhoga, and then in Brihadarvasamrita, when the Sambhoga is described, it's so amazing how all the cow... I don't know why I always get this image, but the cowherd men and women are meeting Krishna as he's coming back from the cowherd the forest. They're all running so ecstatically with various paraphernalia, even deeper. So all these things are going on in the spiritual world. They also worship Krishna and Braja like that. But they're so greedy to get Krishna's association after a long day of separation that when they're running, it's described how they're tripping and, you know, like falling down and rolling. I get an image of like a football player like running and then, you know, he's like tripping and then rolling on the ground and getting up and that, you know, because he's so eager to get the touchdown, you know. So similarly, anyway, again, a ropey tone, this problem can come up. This is a crude example just to give you a sense of the eagerness to meet Krishna after separation. So they're running, they're falling on the ground, they're tripping. It's a very beautiful description given in the Brihadarvasamrita. So the last two verses of Shishasham express the conditions of prema and separation and meeting, which is constantly taking place in Krishna's pastimes. And this way, the whole verse details the whole process of bhakti very exquisitely. And the details of all these verses can be sussed out by studying the Bhajana Rahasya Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He doesn't give a very detailed commentary. What he does is just give tons of shlokas from the Bhagavatam for each verse. And he ends each section with a verse from the Govinda Lilamrita as an appropriate verse for meditation at that particular stage of bhakti. And that way, you have to study the verses very carefully and see kind of meditate on what's Bhaktivinoda Thakur's line of thought. This is not exactly meant for our bhajan necessarily, but it's to give it's like a padati. A padati is like a manual that is given to help one's own bhajan, to culture one's own bhajan. It's not that one has to exactly follow the exact bhava that is being indicated by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but it becomes like a manual which can help one to do the same. Like that. That's where that description comes from. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. I just want to know for like information's sake or just to get clarity. When you were explaining in Raghunuga, there's five stages, Shravanam Dasha and Varnam Dasha. When you were speaking about Shravanam Dasha, you explained that this stage refers specifically to hearing katha exclusively that nourishes one's particular sthayi bhav. And my question is, suppose someone is, you know, fortunate enough to get to that stage in this life, is there this kind of katha somewhere out there that he can access or she can access? Or is it the same lectures that we normally hear, but he'll be like different things will be awakened in his consciousness based on his advanced
realizations? It can be both. You know, it can be both. It means that from one who has such realization, externally he keeps himself as a neophyte. Prabhupada likes to use this language. So he'll come to the same rudimentary programs that we all go to without taste. And he'll come with taste. And he sees the same activities in context of nourishing his own, or you say he will take from those activities the aspects which are nourishing to his own bhava. Because we're also a preaching movement, so it's not like we can just go, at least for those of us who are desiring to assist Srila Prabhupada somehow or other in whatever small way in this movement, it's not like we can just go and isolate ourselves from the association of devotees. So we one would keep himself, as far as our desire to serve Srila Prabhupada is concerned, we will keep ourselves within the open vision of devotees and doing the same programs as any other devotee attending the same classes and so on. But when hearing, such devotees will take those elements of the discussion which are nourishing for their own Krishna consciousness. Or they can take all the elements and assess it in such a way that it's nourishing for their own Krishna consciousness. Just like when you read Srila Prabhupada's purports, there are many elements of his purports that are quite esoteric in nature. And usually those sentences are glossed over because none of us understand what they're talking about. But for such a devotee, he can take all those various elements and take those elements in order to nourish his own Krishna consciousness in such a way. And whereas the other, and I'm talking about a practitioner. Now, if you're a perfected soul, you can relish everything. And you can see it from the context of your relationship, because you're already situated in your relationship. But when you're trying to cultivate that, practice is different from perfection. So sometimes we hear that the devotee relishes everything. But what type of devotee? One who's already got the context of the realization of his relationship with Krishna. Whereas the practitioner will be a little bit more discriminating for the purpose of gaining that relationship that he's trying to culture. And so for practitioners who are advanced practitioners in the practice, they will take elements from the basic rudimentary program. Just like Krishna's, the various programs of deity worship are also taking place in the times of day and Krishna's performing his Ashtakaliya Leela. So various advanced devotees may be coming in the Mangala Arati with that type of context in their mind and finding the Mangala Arati very relishing. Whereas the rest of us are like, man, when is it going to get over? You know, he's playing Mridanga too loud. This one's singing too loud. He's a little off. And so there will be different emotional content going on for both practitioners. Otherwise, it is also highly possible that, you know, at least they might find other Sangha within our movement. I'm sure they're also within our movement. That where they can just get into it, you know, and just relish the kata, you know, no neophytes allowed, you know, lock the doors. And such Sangha will be there also. Both will be there. So there you'll have advanced devotees who, you know, they appear before the people and, you know, do the preaching thing and so on and go to the classes and et cetera. And then they have their own personal Sangha of devotees in which they get together and they just relish, you know, and you're like, oh, can I come? No. You know, you don't have the adhikar. You know, they won't say it like that. They'll just say, no. And, you know, period, and without any explanation and so on. So both, I think both are highly possible. I know because we have to speak in a way that's relevant for everyone when we're preaching. So we tend to want to give a type of answer that says that, you know, they come to everything, they do everything. But the fact of the matter is some may not actually do that. According to their level, and like I said, according to that individual's desire to participate in Prabhupada's preaching movement, they will do certain things that are externally applicable and acceptable for everyone. There may be others who, not that they're not desirous to assist the Prabhupada, but they may see their role in a much less feature, and they're just like kind of absorbing themselves in a particular sort of way. And I personally feel that's equally viable. From the context that there's going to be enough conditioned souls that need liberation for the rest of eternity. And therefore, sometimes some devotees will take a more, you know, kind of like somewhat secluse, you know, reclusive sort of stance in their own practices, keeping themselves rather aloof from all sorts of affairs and so on. I think of Ajahn Prabhu a lot because, you know, he comes to mind. Because he used to like to propagate that Bhajanananda is important. You know, a real Goshtiyanandi is one who's a Bhajanananda who preaches. He would often say like that. A Goshtiyanandi is a Bhajanananda who preaches. And unless you're experiencing happiness from your own bhajan or practice, you can hardly hope to preach anything very substantial for anyone. But in his own, although he would speak like that, he lived amongst the association of devotees in his spiritual master's institution. And he never left, although he had the idea to leave many times because of the type of pressure he was getting. But he once told that he wanted to be, at the time of death, he wanted to be able to, he said, I want to at least stay 50 years in my spiritual master's institution so that at the time of death, I can tell my spiritual master that I served in his mission for at least 50 years. I don't know why the word 50, but he mentioned in this way. And so it was important for him to remain within the institution of his spiritual master because he wanted to assist, but he wanted to assist in his own particular way. And so he preached in a way that was a little bit much different from what we normally hear and so on. as a servant of Srila Prabhupada. So I from the sense of what I understand from my studies and hearing, that both are highly possible. It is highly possible that someone can be more exclusive and less concerned about other sorts of, like hearing all the cantos and so on. I feel that is actually possible. Although generally, he keeps himself as a neophyte, so he also goes to the classes and he can take from everything elements of what nourishes his own particular bhava, like that. Anything else anyone wants to ask? Anything certain? Yeah. I said one commentator on the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu said it is more rare to achieve lobha, which is the basic qualification for Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti, than it is to achieve bhava by Vaidhi Bhakti. So he's saying that you're more likely to achieve bhava by Vaidhi Bhakti than you are to achieve lobha, you know, which comes by the mercy of some devotee or the Supreme Lord himself. So in other words, he kind of stressed that lobha is not such a cheap thing. That's the point. He speaks somewhat conservatively about lobha. Many other branches of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, they speak more liberally about lobha. By saying, if you have an attraction to the Braja Gopas and Gopis in the pastimes, then that itself is lobha, which can be true in a certain context, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that just as Sarana Bhakti has three stages, you can have Kanishta Adhikar, Madhyam Adhikar, or Uttama Adhikar in the stage of for Vaidhi Bhakti. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that also for Raghunuga Sarana Bhakti, there are also three stages based on the intensity of the lobha. So there can be like a Kanishta lobha, a Madhyama lobha, and a Uttama lobha. And someone just has the idea of Braja Bhakti, it can be said that he has lobha in a Kanishta sense. Kanishta sense means that he's attracted to the ideal of Braja Bhakti, which is natural, which you would think would be natural by joining the Gaudiya Sampradaya, that you get attracted to the idea of Braja Bhakti because that's the idea they were propagating. But because you require so much of your intellect in order to keep you from deviating, so your lobha is not very strong. So it can be said that you have a Kanishta lobha, and then there's Madhyama, and then Uttama lobha. Uttama lobha, which is a pure lobha, which happens at the stage of Ruchi. This is how Bhaktivinoda Thakur categorizes it in the Bhakti Tattva Vivek. And that says that lobha is so intense that the attraction to matter is much is weaker, is practically not there. Otherwise, if it's there, your lobha will be brought into question, by revolutionaries like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. What type of lobha is this? You're still hanging out with women and so on, like that, for which people don't like, but he makes us take an honest approach to our level realization.
Your answer perfectly makes sense, but Prabhu, what I was understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, if in Vaidhi Bhakti, when you increase to the bhava stage, it culminates into the Raghunuga stage, lobha.
No. There's two types of sadhanas that lead to perfection. One sadhana is called Vaidhi Bhakti, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. Another is called Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. And one, the difference between the type of bhava that is generated from each type of sadhana is that the bhava that's generated from the application of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is filled with the knowledge of Krishna's opulence, which is suitable for Dasarasa. Whereas the type of bhava that is generated from Raghunuga Sarana Bhakti is Madhurya, or Kevala Bhakti, which is mentioned, Kevala Bhava and Kevala Prema, mentioned by Rupa Goswami, where the knowledge of Krishna's opulence is suppressed by that type of devotion. So the flavor of bhava or prema that is generated from the different types of sadhanas are not the same. That's clearly described in the part of the Nectar Devotion we're allowed to read or encouraged to read. This description is clearly given. So it is not that automatically one, by following the rudimentary programs, automatically one's going to get lobha and etc. That loba is actually a gracious grant of sadhu or Krishna, according to the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So one has to gain it from a devotee who's filled with such type of devotion in his heart. And then according to his maturity or practice, he becomes eligible to actually apply those aspects of sadhana himself. But to get the minimum qualification is really a gracious grant of the absolute in the form of God or his devotee. So it's not that it's exactly automatic. That I'll follow Vaidhi all the way up to Bhava, and then from Bhava I'll become eligible for sadhana. That doesn't make sense. It's not that you have to become perfect before you're eligible for practice to become perfect. That will be a highly clumsy understanding. So there are two paths that lead to perfection in bhakti, and they generate a different flavor. Bhava is bhava, it's spontaneous, but the flavor of the bhava is different. Yeah, so I saw his hand in his hand, and then you can go. You can hand it to Himanshu Guru, and then he wants to ask something.
It's a quick question. You were saying that loba you get by the mercy of a devotee. So I'm assuming
for
that
the Lord.
Okay, so in case of getting it from the devotee, I'm assuming you get it by hearing from that devotee. So yeah. How should we hear from such a devotee that we can get their inner...
By hearing. You hear from the devotee by hearing. Generally, the idea is that he wants to ask something next. Generally, by hearing, it means by hearing the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam and so on. But in general, it means by hearing from the devotee who has that sort of attraction. Because it's coming from the context of that inner emotional content, that anything he speaks is going to be filled with such emotional content. And so there's why it's mentioned that Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions in Chaitanya Shikshamrita that the Bhav Bhakta, he can elevate the Sadaka immediately to the stage of Ruchi just by his personality. Which I always found really a remarkable statement, because when he describes the Sadakas, he says Vaidhi Sadakas or Rag Sadakas, they can only elevate a person to faith by their teaching and example. So therefore, we always hear about the importance of understanding the Siddhanta and setting up a proper example. But the Bhav Bhakta, it says by his personality, he can elevate a person to the stage of Ruchi. So that means that his personality becomes so attractive and everything he speaks will be filled with his particular emotional content in relationship to Krishna. So anything you hear from such a person will be attractive to you and generate an attraction to his ideal, even in a subconscious sort of way, where it may not be so much in the forefront of the mind in the very beginning, but even in a subconscious sort of way, that type of attraction is generated just by being with him, and his personality is filled with such. And I practically have that experience, that's exactly what happens. Even if they don't speak esoteric things to you, although hearing generally means hearing the 10th canto, but I do have the experience that even if one doesn't speak such things to you, just by being with them, all of a sudden that ideal comes in your heart by hearing anything that they speak to you. Because whatever they speak is filled with that emotional content, such as the power of their devotion to God. One time I heard a nice little story, Prabhupada's story, where I forget what the context was, but something bogus was going on or something. So Prabhupada said, we should drop bombs on them, you know. And he said it in a very, like seriously, kind of partially playful, but kind of serious mood, we should drop bombs on them. So one devotee asked a senior devotee, he said, you know, how am I to understand this? Probably, you know, the devotee is supposed to be all compassionate and merciful, and he's talking about we should drop bombs on them, and so how am I supposed to understand that? And so this devotee gave a very interesting answer to the senior devotee. The senior devotee told that, well, Prabhupada, his own Baba was as a cowherd boy, and there's a lot of evidence demonstrating that, and Prabhupada himself indicating that in these several places, even his own poem indicates that his own Baba was in the Sakya Rasa. So this devotee explained that Srila Prabhupada's own bhava was actually coming out. So a cowherd boy, that's not going to be such a significant. We should drop bombs on them, you know. If for one who has that type of inner emotional content, then that's a very, it's a playful statement, and you know, serious, but playful at the same time. And so the emotional content of Prabhupada was so situated. So this devotee explained that Prabhupada's bhava was just coming out. Although they try to conceal it, you know, by their dhirashtrachanamuti, by their sobriety. But naturally, because of the nature of emotion, it comes out naturally and spontaneously. And so his own bhava was coming out. So although hearing can generally mean hearing the 10th canto, it could be just mean associating with them and just sucking in their personality, or rather I should say being sucked in by their personality, which is all attractive, just as Krishna is all attractive. So Krishna's Shakti, Swarup Shakti, is all attractive. And because Bhav Prema is an investment on the Swarup Shakti in the heart of the devotee, so then that devotee also becomes all attractive. And so such association alone is sufficient to excite higher sense of devotion like that. Yeah.
One point that I wanted to make was early on in your class you mentioned reading about Krishna book, and I heard from one devotee early on in his devotional life that we should read it with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of focus, you know, not like a newspaper or something like that, because then we'll be able to qualify that what Krishna Bhagavan is doing, we cannot do. So we will see the Ras Leela and other Ras as something only Bhagavan can do. And we will not try to imitate those activities in our own life as jivas here in the material world. Second point is a little bit of a technical point. I don't know if you know, we want to really go into it, but just for clarification and importance, I'll mention that actually lobh, moh, kam, krodh, dam, matsar, kapat, these things are to be avoided. And if we want ruchi to take place, we actually have to have lolyam, which is the technical Sanskrit.
Well, the word lolyam and loba are both used to describe the...
Both evenness. Used, but lolyam is qualified that is specifically for spiritual greed.
Well,
because
loba,
in prasad seva, lobha moya sudharmati.
Yeah, that loba is different. So anyway, the word loba is also used in relationship to the
that's what I mentioned.
Yeah. Those who are desiring spiritual perfection. So where lolyam is used, the word loba is also used to describe the eagerness of those who are seeking spiritual perfection. Just as the word kama is used to describe the love of the gopis. And so the acharyas will always say that this kama is not the mundane kama, but it actually refers to prema. So sometimes the prema of the Braja gopis are described as kama. So the acharyas always point out to us that it should not be confused with material lust. So similarly, loba is also is also used to describe those who are eager. It's actually called loba mayi shraddha, ones whose faith is filled with loba. And so both words are actually used.
But for simplicity, it would be nicer to...
Well, share that with... Tell that to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. You wanted to say something?
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Actually, I have a question from your answer. That many times we ask something from devotee and we hear no, that you are not allowed or this is no for you.
And that makes you more.
That makes us more interested in that thing. So how to take this message in a positive way or in a correct way as a neophyte devotee?
Well, when I gave that example of the no, I was saying that devotees have their own like kind of sanghas, and we don't know exactly what's going on, but we know we're attracted. And so we say, well, can we come to the program? They say no. So the only way you can get around that is if you can somehow sneak in, which is practically impossible. But then your question is, how do we take the no messages in a positive light? I mean, the best way to try to take it in a positive light, I mean, no one likes to be told no, right? But the best way you could possibly take it in a positive light is to see the need to gain adhikar for that particular activity, for which we're not being told no because it is not wanted for us, but we're being told no on account of our adhikar. So then we could try to take it in a positive way by trying to get the adhikar, for which the answer yes can come. Just like we sing every morning, Seva adhikara diya kuru nijadasi, please give me the seva adhikar by which I can become a nijadasi. So similarly, we can try to take it positively in that way, although if we're not humble enough, I doubt we will take it positively. But the messages get the a qualification. Sve sve adhikaraya nishta saguna parikirtita. Bhaktivinoda Thakur likes to use this verse that those who are, what is piety and impiety? Piety refers to being fixed according to one's adhikar. Sve sve adhikaraya nishta. According to one's adhikar, nishta, be fixed in that. That is called as piety. And impiety is just the opposite of that. Viparya means just the opposite of that is impiety. So when one tries to reach for something that's beyond his reach at a present stage, that is called as impiety. So the basic message of coming down in the Bhaktivinoda Thakur's line is that there should be proper adhikar. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks a lot about adhikar in his literatures, and so also Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada. So the no message is not no because it's not wanted for us, but it's a no because we may be unqualified. So then we have to just ask ourselves, what is the level of our realization? You know, how do I hold up in the face of duality? And so on. You can just do a little self-check. How am I applying, you know, nectar instruction 1 through 6? Am I very good at that? Can I avoid prajalpa, or do I still find taste for those? And so on. So then there's a reason why the no is there. Like that. That's the only way you could try to take it positively. Although I think some persons lacking insufficient, lacking humility, then they may take the no and go, well, I'm going to do it anyway. At which point, there's a chance they might become degraded. If they lack the adhikar, there's a chance that we might actually become degraded. And so there's a reason why you don't cast pearls before swine. So, on that very positive note, we'll end the discussion here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.